content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the theme of the October issue of Our State Magazine, which is Mountain Masterpieces. And this article, our first article, is entitled Home on the Range. The steep canyon rangers have soared to great heights, playing some of their most iconic stages in the world, yet their roots remain firmly planted in the mountains of North Carolina. Well, after midnight, the steep canyon rangers tour bus drops into a lower gear as it climbs west through the Blue Ridge. I'm tucked away in a sleeping bunk, flopping like a fish as we wind through the mountains toward Nashville, where the Rangers are playing the Grand Ole Opry tomorrow night. As a seasoned author who's been on countless book tours, I'm used to traveling by plane, train, and automobile, but I've never tried to sleep, at least not lying down, on a bus. I've known the Rangers for years, and I've seen them play everywhere from the Brevard Music Center to a record shop in Raleigh. But tomorrow's Opry show will be my first time seeing the band play outside of North Carolina. And tonight's my first overnight stay on the bus. Soon I give up on sleep, climb out of the bunk, and silently make my way to the front of the bus, where a light's still burning, signaling that a few of the Rangers might still be awake. I find banjo player Graham Sharp and bassist guitarist Barrett Smith hanging out in the galley, sipping beers. Outside, the night whips by, cold and dark. Autumn is not yet past, and a few leaves still cling to the trees. I take a seat on the sofa beside Sharp and rub my tired eyes. It usually only takes one night to get your bus legs, Sharp says. You'll sleep like a baby tomorrow night. Smith passes me a beer and talk turns to home. I listen as the two bandmates share stories of life in West Asheville, where they've lived for more than 20 years. The rest of the band members make their homes in the mountains as well. Mandolin player Mike Gugino and drummer Mike Ashworth live in Brevard. Singer and guitarist Aaron Burdett lives in Saluda. Fiddle player Nicky Sanders lives near Sharp and Smith in West Asheville. Much of the Rangers' musical repertoire comes from the old-time bluegrass traditions forged in Appalachia. These mountains have also forged the individual members in ways that remain in their hearts, even when they're traveling the world. I can relate. I wrote my first novel after years spent living in North Carolina mountains, and I've felt their tug ever since. It's not something that is easy to leave behind. A current of Blue Ridge nostalgia courses through much of what I've written, and the same can be said of the Rangers' music. It's the landscape I tend to miss, Sharp says. I miss the quiet places where I can catch my breath. I miss the woods. I miss my porch. Although we're sitting side by side on the tour bus as it streaks through the dark, if I were to close my eyes, I could easily conjure the experience of sitting on Sharp's porch, the rocking of the bus seamlessly replaced by rocking chairs, the scent of wood smoke and smoldering leaves on the wind. It was just under the influence of his little corner of western North Carolina that Sharp wrote Hominy Valley, the track that opens 2023's Morning Shift, the band's most recent studio album. The neighborhood fought it when some money was from Charlotte, bought up that river bend, but the church owned the land and they needed the cash, and their lawyers got an easy win. So look who's moving in now. Who am I to run my mouth about Hominy Valley? I think he's watching me now. The song is about the legend of Native American tracker who was poisoned by the Union Army for assisting the Confederacy. The story goes that the man was buried beneath an oak tree, the same one that Sharp passes daily in his neighborhood. The old oak and the man rumored to be buried beneath it have watched over the valley as trees have been cut down and homes built in their place, something that Sharp recognizes in his own move to West Asheville, amidst a landscape that's undergoing constant physical and cultural change. Marking these changes was one of Smith's favorite things to do when he takes his daily jogs over the solid earth of western North Carolina after days or weeks on the bus. His route down Haywood Road, the main artery that runs through West Asheville, carries him past everything from the public library and local market to dive bars and high-end restaurants. Running on Haywood Road through the heart of the community gives me a chance to check in with people who've been here a long time, Smith says. It's also a way to get to know new people. It's a true West Asheville experience. By now, the beers in our hands have grown warm, and I've grown tired, ready to give the sleeping bunk another try. Sharp looks at me and raises his eyebrows. So, he says, what did you think life on the tour bus would be like? I smile and point out the fact that we're three dads up past our bedtime, drinking beer in our pajamas, talking about how much we miss the mountains. I don't want to disappoint y'all, I say, but this is exactly what I thought it would be like. Although the Rangers now make their homes in the region that defines them, that's not where it all started. The legend is well known in North Carolina music circles. In the late 90s, a trio of undergrads at UNC Chapel Hill got together to play a little bluegrass. Soon, the three friends, Sharp, Woody Platt, and Charles Humphrey III, formed a band called the Steep Canyon Rangers, along with Platt's childhood friend, Gugino. In the early 2000s, the three UNC grads headed west toward Platt and Gugino's native Brevard and rented a ramshackle cabin south of Asheville in the community of Cedar Mountain. The cabin had shoddy electricity and lacked indoor plumbing. Platt's father proclaimed, "Y'all can't live this way." He had a port-a-john delivered to the property the next day. The Rangers were already on the rise. Over the next two decades, the band would release 14 albums, win a Grammy Award for 2012's Nobody Knows You, and be inducted into the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame. They would also collaborate with musician and comedian Steve Martin on three full-length albums, and they continue to perform with him alongside his friend, the comedian Martin Short. As the Rangers' lives have changed over the years, so has the lineup. Sanders joined the man in 2004 and Ashworth in 2013. Humphrey departed in 2017 and Smith joined soon after. The newest member is Burdett, who came aboard in 2022 and Platt stepped away to spend more time with his family. Born and raised in Saluda, where he now lives with his wife and daughters, Burdett was shocked when he was tapped to join the Rangers. He got the call while on a work site with his construction company. Less than 3 weeks later, his first show with the band marked the beginning of a three-night stand at the Hollywood Bowl with Martin and Short. He was a long way from Saluda, where he'd spent more time swinging a hammer than he had holding a guitar. It used to be 20% music, 80% construction, he said, but now it's the opposite. We're sitting in the Women of Country room backstage at the Grand Ole Opry. Photos of country and bluegrass legends like Alison Krauss and Patsy Cline line the walls, staring down at visiting bands like distant deities. This is Burdett's first time playing the Opry, and it's impossible to escape the gravitas of such holy ground. It's cool to know we can play these iconic venues in these huge metropolitan areas, but then I get to go home to Saluda with its main street and a little grill and the post office and everything right there in walking distance. He laughs and looks up at the portraits on the wall. It's kind of like leading a double life. Sanders' life back home, too, is much quieter than life on the road. He spends a lot of time in his West Asheville garden, minding watering schedules and the cycle of seasons while tending to various species of pine, cypress, cedar, and spruce. Conifers are king, he says with a smile. I consider myself a one-man reforestation project. When the band takes the stage at the Opry, Sanders brings the audience to his feet with his torrential energy, and it's hard to imagine him holding a garden hose or a shovel instead of a fiddle. To close out the show, the band launches into Tell the Ones I Love, a song about leaving town. Ashworth's drums take on the propulsive drive of steam engine's wheels, and Sanders' fiddle sounds an awful lot like a train whistle blasting out a few last notes of departure. Last train before they shut it down, Sharp and Smith sing. It's the last line going that way. Later that night, we're back on the bus, headed east across Tennessee toward the Blue Ridge. As the band and crew members drift toward their bunks, Ashworth and Gugino listen to a live recording of a show they performed at Wilmington's Greenfield Lake Amphitheater last fall. Ashworth is the techie of the band, and he often records their shows. This performance was strong, and the Rangers have decided to release it as an album. Along with Platt, the two Mikes grew up together in Brevard, where they now live with their own families. Mike and I met on the first day of high school, Gugino says. We were wearing the same Pink Floyd t-shirt, so we started talking. The two men now have 6 children between them, and Gugino has another one on the way. Their teenage sons are close friends, and the bandmates appreciate the fact that their kids' childhoods in Brevard are so similar to their own. The boys go downtown and hang out at the soda fountain, just like we did, Ashworth says. Brevard is a special place because it seems trapped in time. I've been to every state and a lot of countries, Gugino adds. I've learned that Brevard is one of the best places in the world to live. Not everyone can look out their window and see beautiful mountains or drive 5 minutes and be at a waterfall. If you grow up in a small town and you don't travel a lot, you can take things like that for granted. The lights of Nashville are far behind us now. We'll be home before dawn. I say goodnight to the two Mikes and settle into my bunk, the swaying of the bus now soothing me as we head into the mountains. Sharp was right. I sleep like a baby. Our next article is entitled Craft Revival. Handmade goods are a living, breathing tradition in our mountain communities. For almost a century, the Southern Highland Craft Guild has preserved trades like weaving, carving, metalworking, and more. The airy gallery of the Folk Art Center, tucked within the forests of the Blue Ridge Parkway outside Asheville, is a riot of color and shape. Here, the Southern Highland Craft Guild has curated some of the most creative work from across western North Carolina and 8 other states in the Appalachian Mountains. The eye dances across clay sculptures like hunks of pastel seafoam and coral, flawless furniture with hypnotic swirls of lumber grain, silver jewelry hammered into miniature wearable boulders. By comparison, the sample of cloth displayed in the center's permanent collection seems almost plain at first sight. A thin wooden frame surrounds a tightly woven wool and cotton, colored in gradations of brown with natural chestnut oak dye. Yet the deeper you look, the more the work reveals itself. It's double bow knot design, pulsing like a magic eye poster. That cloth serves as a constant reminder of why any of this beauty is here to begin with. It's taken from a production of a coverlet given by Frances Louisa Goodrich in 1895 by Rebecca Taylor Davis in Britton Cove, a tiny settlement in rural Buncombe County. Goodrich had come to the area as a teacher, Presbyterian missionary, and social activist, seeking to uplift rural people in the spirit of Christian charity. But she also brought a sophisticated aesthetic eye, having studied art at the Yale School of Fine Arts and in New York City. In the intricate pattern of the coverlet, she saw an excellence of craft, along with a money-making market for a region with few other economic opportunities. She got this idea that a craft industry might be the thing to do because women could do it in their homes in their spare time, says Annie Chesky, a historian and executive director of Presbyterian Heritage Center in Monterey. And it could be marketed to Northerners who were having this revival of interest in home crafts. Western North Carolina was uniquely fertile ground for a craft industry to take off, Chesky explains. Although the isolation of its mountain hollers had kept many communities poor, it had also fostered a tradition of self-reliance, with a history of residents making goods to meet their needs instead of buying them from elsewhere. Those skills had started to fade by the time of Goodrich's work, thanks to the arrival of the railroad and, with it, factory-made products in 1880, but still circulated among older generations. Goodrich helped organize the mountaineers as they sewed quilts, hooked rugs, and crafted furniture for sale, traveling between remote outposts on her trusty pony Cherokee. By 1902, the missionary started selling these wares from a shop called Allen's Stand in Madison County, so named for a log building, Allen's Old Stand, once used by drovers as they herded hogs, turkeys, and cattle from Tennessee to South Carolina. The business thrived, especially after it moved to downtown Asheville and started capturing interest from the city's burgeoning tourism scene. Monies made from the sale of their crafts have put a cow in the barn, shingles on the roof, and shoes on their children so they could go to school in the winter, Woodrich wrote in a report to her missionary supervisors. Similar efforts began to pop up across Appalachia, and in 1930, Goodrich helped establish the Southern Highland Craft Guild as a guiding force for the craft revival movement. She transferred the Allen Stand shop to the organization in 1931. Nearly 100 years later, the Guild's flagship store at the Folk Art Center still bears the same name, and the group itself remains animated by Goodrich's vision, helping mountaineers make a living powered by craft and heritage. The Southern Highland Craft Guild's past informs the way it navigates current challenges, says glassblower Michael Hatch, a Guild member since 2005. After earning a master's degree in critical craft studies from Warren Wilson College in 2020, he began working at the group as the group's archivist. In a small office at the Folk Arts Center, Hatch lays out the parallels between the Guild's origins and modern times. Back then, he points out that mountaineers accustomed to local goods were amazed by the variety on offer through the mail-order Sears and Roebuck catalog. Now, internet shopping platforms entice spending away from the area makers. From 19th-century railroads to today's hulking container ships, Hatch says increased globalization keeps pitting skilled craft against factory labor. In the 1900s and 2000s, people were going back to other countries with pictures of stuff and creating production lines for it, he says. All of a sudden, Pier 1 was selling your work for pennies on the dollar of what you sell it for. Like Goodrich's coverlet, the Guild's response to those forces weaves many strands together. The warp, the thread that gives the Guild structure, has always been world-class quality. In the early Allen Stand days, Goodrich would personally evaluate products according to her exacting standards, raising the bar for the entire craft community. Her legacy carries on through the Guild's mentorship program run by jeweler and glass bead maker Teresa Britton. Prospective members pair up with one of the Guild's more than 800 established crafters who help them understand what the Guild is looking for. The goal, she says, is for each object to reflect mastery in every aspect of its construction. Even if it's a quilt that's a wall hanging, we expect it to be as beautiful on the back as it is on the front, Britton explains. If it's a pottery vase, it needs to sit perfectly flat when you set it on the table, and it should be as well finished on the inside as on the outside. Creative marketing provides the proverbial weft, putting members' products in front of discerning buyers. In 1930, one early effort sent three Appalachian women on a tour of Midwestern department stores where they set up a cabin scene and wove coverlets to drum up interest in the Guild's handicrafts. Live demonstrations still draw people to the Folk Art Center, the Guild's biannual craft fairs in Asheville, and specific event days, but these outlets are now accompanied by a robust online shop and social media presence. The embrace of the new technology is also in keeping with the Guild's past, Hatch says. Despite its roots in traditional skills, the Guild has consistently stayed in conversation with the present. During Goodrich's time, for example, the state-of-the-art Scandinavian looms were imported for mountain weavers to work more efficiently. As the Guild's efforts helped Western North Carolina become a craft destination, the region attracted college-trained artists who brought entirely new ways of working. By the 1960s, visitors to a Guild fair would find Indonesian-style batik cloth and abstract metal sculptures, along corn husk dolls and straw brooms. The diversity of forms has only continued to grow, as evidenced by the displays at the Folk Art Center. We still have heritage members who do very traditional work with traditional materials, but we have a lot of contemporary craftspeople now, too, Hatch says. It's a balancing act of trying to hold on to the past, look to the future, and figure out a way to market them together. And still, those heritage crafts remain, like the coverlet that started it all. Its materials and pattern have endured, and so has the very act of coaxing art from a loom, a proud tradition that weaves the past together with the future. And to find out more information about the Folk Art Center, check out their website at southernhighlandguild.org. And there's another little sub-article here that I'll read called Mastering the Art. As America industrialized in the 1800s, the people of Western North Carolina spun and whittled the natural resources of Appalachia into things of beauty. Out of the woodwork came John C. Campbell Folk School, founded by Olive Dame Campbell and Marguerite Butler in Brasstown in 1925, and Penland School of Craft, established by Lucy Morgan in Bakersville in 1929. Today, instructors at the Folk School might be third-generation woodworkers or blacksmithing doctors who learned their skill as creative outlet, while those at Penland are full-time craftspeople or university teachers. Through immersive workshops and hands-on teaching, the instructors pass on their knowledge. The Folk School invites artists to teach once they've shown a level of mastery in their craft, one based on age-old traditions, modern techniques, and countless hours of practice. Fiber specialist Nancy Hines began quilting as a way to keep busy while watching her kids. In her playful piecing class, she emboldens students to explore intuitively with their design. She herself finds satisfaction in working through the chaos, knowing that instinct is essential to confronting the challenges of craftsmanship. Amy Patansu, who has taught weaving at Penland, also encourages students to trust their intuitions. "My hope for students on a personal level is gaining confidence and courage," she says. "Becoming courageous in terms of being open, being willing to try things that might be a mistake, trusting themselves." So the instructors guide their students to play with ideas and let one click. To test it out, be willing to pivot, then let it come together. To Patansu, those are the pieces that combine excellent craftsmanship and artistry that makes a masterpiece. For more information on the John C. Campbell Folk School, check out their website at folkschool.org, and the Penland School of Craft in Bakersville, and their website is Penland, just like penland.org. Our next article is from the NC Icons section, and it's about Linville Caverns. Water that seeps into Humpback Mountain undergoes a chemical reaction with minerals as it passes through the soil, vegetation, and rock. Over time, it's repositioned and reshaped formations to create the 750-foot-long Linville Caverns. About 2,400 feet beneath Humpback Mountain in McDowell County, Stephen Misticelli leads a tour group through Linville Caverns with his flashlight. Stalactites hang down in various shapes and sizes, almost a mirror image of the Blue Ridge skyline that rises about a half mile above. As he rounds a corner, the low ceilings, on average about 7 or 8 feet tall, jump to 23 feet. "This is what we call our cathedral room," he says. He illuminates a small opening above the walkway, guiding visitors' eyes to a rock formation known as the wedding scene. He points out the rough shape of a bishop holding a staff, standing to the left of a couple. "You can almost hear the church bells," he says. Throughout his tour, Misticelli reveals images in the formation. In eroded limestone, he sees everything from strips of bacon to a T-Rex's smile. In one of the cavern's largest stalactites, coated in algae and moss, he sees the face of a green elephant. This practice is as subjective as looking for shapes in clouds, but if you spent as much time as Misticelli does in the depths of these ancient caverns, you'd start putting faces to rocks, too. Misticelli has joined a long list of visitors who've stumbled upon the caverns, though each saw something different in the natural wonder. For two local fishermen in 1822, the caverns were an answer to a riddle. How were trout swimming straight into solid rock? The men slid through a fissure to discover another world beneath the mountain and the disappearing fish. For lost or deserting Confederate and Union soldiers, the caverns were a refuge from the violence of the Civil War. There was even an alcove that held a small fire to keep the men warm until locals followed the smoke, leading to their discovery. For Thomas Edison, who sent an expedition here in search of platinum for his incandescent lamps, the caverns presented an opportunity for innovation and progress. The 1884 expedition was led by William Earl Hidden, who never found any platinum, but did carve his initials into one of the walls. Today, Miss Ticelli and other guides lead new visitors through the cavern. As its wonders are revealed, they too discover a place that's almost unimaginable. Open to the public since 1937 and owned by the same family since 1940, Linville Caverns are the state's only active limestone caverns that visitors can tour. And there's a picture here of a gentleman looking up at the cavern walls, and there's like, it almost, if it were, it looks wet, it almost looks like it would be green slime coming down the walls, but of course it's not. It's the limestone deposits that are trickling down, so that's interesting. For more information about Linville Caverns, check out their website at linvillecaverns.com. Here's a couple little side articles about this. The Deep End. In Linville Caverns, water drips from the walls and stalactites and flows throughout fissures in the rock, delivering trout and salamanders from the North Fork of the Catawba River into the cavern's cool embrace. But there's one place beneath Humpback Mountain where the walls narrow and the water sits as still as glass. In the corner of the caverns, tour groups carefully step onto a metal grate that rests over the bottomless pool. It got its name in the 1930s when a 250-foot weighted line was dropped into the pool and never touched the bottom. In 2005, divers explored the water, but again, they couldn't locate the bottom. Some have even used underwater cameras to navigate the pool, but because of the many ledges along its walls, it's almost impossible to determine where the bottom is, if there is one. Tour guide Stephen Misticelli has other theories. He thinks that those folks in the 1930s just needed a longer line. Standing over the pool, he says with a wink, "I believe that's 251 feet. And then we have cavern critters. When you're touring Linville Cavern, pay attention to the dark corners, nooks, and crannies. You might just see some of the cavern's year-round residents. Trout and salamanders. As you walk through the door that separates the caverns from the outside world, a stream from the nearby river parallels your path. That's where salamanders and mountain trout enter the caverns. Tour guides throw trout food their way throughout the day. Bats. Hundreds of bats once hibernated in the caverns, but their numbers have been dwindling due to white nose syndrome. Bats help control insect populations in and outside the caverns, so if you're lucky enough to see one, say thank you. Spiders. If you spot a tiny eight-legged creature while you're ducking under stalactites, you could be looking at the rare Linville Cavern spider. The arachnid's orange and yellow coloring blends into the walls, which might explain why it wasn't discovered until 1947. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired and is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.